information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
Appear to border
and it shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
In the United States Senate has been a better friend to Israel than Media Monarchy. Welcome to episode 94 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 3rd, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you from Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network, your source for news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week we got Biden, Palin, and Zion, Bear, Iran, Chuck Norris, and Northcom, Portland postal plot and Simpsons vote fraud, West Virginia miners, eminent domain, and mountaintop McCain, dictators, drills, eugenics, bailouts, rescues, and a new financial world order. It's all here on episode 94, October 3rd, 2008. It's MediaMonarchy.com. Sound the alarm, my friends. Sound the alarm. Order the attack. It's martial law. Beat Babylon back. That's brand new music from DC's Thievery Corporation from their new record, Radio Retaliation. And we'll get a little more into that a little later on and hear another cut from that record. But before all that, my friends, let me again welcome you to episode 94 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 3rd, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time on the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info, revereradionetwork.com. You can also hear it blasting out LPFM style, thanks to KBFR in Boulder and 87.9 Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta. And you can, of course, hit me up on MySpace, Dig, YouTube, and Yahoo with Media Monarchy as your keyword, and also IM and Skype. And I want to thank Spencer out in Chicago and Greg in Italy, who does some graphics work for 8 Estate and Richard Andrew Grove. So I want to say thanks to Spencer and Greg for making contact on IM. And of course, iTunes, radioforall.net, and archive.org for the podcast. Hopefully you caught the B-side, 93B, a few days ago. Again, as I've been saying, too much is going on to contain it all in a mere two-hour weekly show. So I've been doing a little exclusive homemade podcast without any time constraint. So subscribe to the feed and get all the shows, because you won't hear those on Portland Radio Authority or Revere. So, all that business out of the way, let's get to the more serious business. And yes, we had the big one and only VP debate last night. I think everybody was amped up and thought it was going to be hilarious. It was going to be Thursday Night Live. But ultimately, crazy Palin, ridiculous and unqualified as she may be, more or less stood her ground. The thing that popped out at me, of course, is always the big issue of who loves Israel more. No, I love Israel. No, I love Israel more. I'll defend them better. And of course, Palin has said that the only flag in her office is an Israeli flag. So, top of the page right now, selection 08, Palin versus Biden. We both love Israel.
Done right or wrong, this is the great lingering unresolved issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. What have they done? And is a two-state solution the solution?
A two-state solution is the solution. And Secretary Rice, having recently met with leaders on one side or the other, they're also still in these waning days of the Bush administration trying to forge that peace. And that needs to be done. And that will be top of an agenda item also under a McCain-Palin administration. Israel is our strongest and best ally in the Middle East. We have got to assure them that we will never allow a second Holocaust, despite, again, warnings from Iran and any other country that would seek to destroy Israel, that that is what they would like to see. We will support Israel. A two-state solution, building our embassy also in Jerusalem, those things that we look forward to being able to accomplish with this peace-seeking nation. And they have a track record of being able to forge these peace agreements. They succeeded with Jordan. They succeeded with Egypt. I'm sure that we're going to see more success there also. It's got to be a commitment of the United States of America, though. And I can promise you, in a McCain-Palin administration, that commitment is there to work with our friends in Israel.
Senator.
No one in the United States Senate has been a better friend to Israel than Joe Biden. I would have never, ever joined this ticket where I'm absolutely sure Barack Obama shared my passion. But you asked the question about whether or not this administration's policy had made sense or something to that effect. It has been an abject failure. This administration's policy. In fairness to Secretary Rice, she's trying to turn it around now in the seventh or eighth year. Here's what the president said when we said no. He insisted on elections on the West Bank when I said and others said and Barack Obama said, big mistake. Hamas will win the legitimized. And what happened? Hamas won. When we kicked, along with France, we kicked Hezbollah out of Lebanon. I said and Barack said, move NATO forces in there. Fill the vacuum. Because if you don't, Hezbollah will control it. Now what's happened? Hezbollah is a legitimate part of the government in the country immediately to the north of Israel. The fact of the matter is the policy of this administration has been an abject failure. And speaking of freedom being on the march, the only thing on the march is Iran. It's closer to a bomb. Its proxies now have a major stake in Lebanon as well as in the Gaza Strip with Hamas. We will change this policy with thoughtful, real-life diplomacy that understands that you must back Israel in letting them negotiate, support their negotiation, and stand with them, not insist on policies like this administration has.
Has this administration's policy been an abject failure, as the senator says, Governor?
No, I do not believe that it has been, but I'm so encouraged to know that we both love Israel, and I think that is a good thing to get to agree on, Senator Biden. I respect your position on that.
Poor Israel. Poor defenseless Israel with billions of dollars and tons of nukes. So that's Palin and Biden arguing over who loves Israel more. And, of course, also beating the drums and fear-mongering about Iran, which segues into our next bit from former CIA operative Bob Baer, B-A-E-R. Now, of course, we've mentioned him several times before. He's more or less the guy that Syriana is based on, and he says that 9/11 looks probably to be like an inside job. However, he's always on the Iran's going to get us tip, so I haven't quite figured that out. So from Raw Story, Baer on, of course, Fox News says that an Iran strike would cause a serious depression. A former CIA agent and expert on Iran offered a grim assessment of American options in dealing with that nation, saying that sanctions have failed, surgical strikes will lead to unacceptable retaliation against U.S. interests, but a conventional war and an invasion would look like World War III.
Hey, Quran, be more serious threat to the U.S. than we realize. You know, that little country. How long can the Islamic Republic taunt the West without repercussions? Former CIA operative, famous guy Bob Baer, the author of The Devil We Know. Bob, do you think that Israel is prepared to attack Iran since they are moving ahead and laughing at the sanctions?
Well, I think absolutely. The sanctions have failed. They called Bush's bluff. The Israelis are preparing for an attack, and they're telling us, you either do something about Iran now, today, or we're going to hit. And I hear it could be early first quarter of next year.
True or false, Omar sat down with Bush and said, I need your permission and backing to bomb Iran's facilities.
Absolutely. They've been pressing for this. They said, we want to do it now. We need your help. We need overflight. And Bush said no.
Israel hits Iran's facilities like they hit Iraq's in 83. Is that it?
No. This cannot be a surgical strike. They are going to retaliate. They, the Iranians, are going to hit the Saudi oil facilities. It's going to hit tankers. They're going to hit our troops in Iraq. And
why would they hit Saudi Arabia if Israel hits their nuclear facilities?
Pure deterrence. What they're going to do is they're going to take off 17 million barrels of oil a day in the Gulf. And that is what they consider their deterrence and to push us into a serious depression.
Are our troops in danger in Iraq if Israel hits the nuclear sites in Iran?
Absolutely. We're going to feel the effect. This is what Bush told Olmert. He said, you do that and we're going to feel it in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. There's a lot of Shia in Afghanistan, a lot of Shia in Iraq, and they will hit our troops all over the country.
Well, couldn't we, from the seas, level Iran?
Oh, absolutely. Conventional war, we could destroy the country in a matter of minutes. But the point is, it's going to look like World War III.
Bob Baer, is it all in The Devil We Know?
It's all in The Devil We Know.
It's the life you lead and the sources you still have.
30 years I've studied Iran and watched the arc of this country, and it is a most serious danger abroad, and I think we have to sit down and see if a deal can cut, because a big war against it could be nothing like Iraq.
I don't know how I sleep at night if I'm Bob Baer, knowing this all could be happening. But Bob, I look forward to talking to you again. I know the book is going to be a bestseller. It's great to see you.
Thanks.
I wish you had better news.
Robert Baer is the author of a new book, The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower, which argues that Iran has already become the leading power in the Middle East, and the U.S. has no choice but to negotiate with us. So, again, the power in the Middle East. And, of course, all the fear-mongering and misconstruing and mistranslating things that Ahmadinejad says. Ay, 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 my friends. And there was more I think I was going to say about that, but now it escapes me. Oh, my God. So let's move on. Let's return to the homeland with more fear-mongering. But this is definitely an important one, and we've touched on this, I believe, in the last couple episodes. And that is the combat brigades
that are now assigned to the homeland starting on October 1st, just a couple days ago. So there's been a bit of back and forth about this, but some of the latest we've got is a piece from Paul Joseph Watson. NORTHCOM denies troops to be used for crowd control. Following the alarming admission that active duty U.S. Army would be on call to deal with civil unrest inside the United States from October 1st, the U.S. Northern Command, U.S. NORTHCOM, has publicly denied that troops will engage in law enforcement duties, but concedes that forces will be armed with both non-lethal and lethal weapons, as well as having access to tanks. So, as was highlighted last week, a September 8th Army Times report stated that active duty troops from the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team are returning from Iraq, and they're going to be on call as a federal response force for natural or man-made emergencies and disasters, including terrorist attacks, for a period supposedly of 12 months. The purpose of the unit's patrols, according to the article in Army Times, includes helping with civil unrest and crowd control, or to deal with potentially horrific scenarios such as massive poisoning and chaos in response to a chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, or high-yield explosives, or CBRN attack, CBRNE. However, a NORTHCOM official, presumably responding to reports featured on this website and others, publicly denies that troops will be used to police Americans, saying, quote, "This response force will not be called upon to help with law enforcement, civil disturbance, or crowd control, but will be used to support lead agencies involved in saving lives, relieving suffering, and meeting the needs of communities affected by weapons of mass destruction, attacks, accidents, or even natural disasters." Army Colonel Michael Boatner, U.S. NORTHCOM Future Operations Division Chief, told Homeland Security Today, that's hstoday.us. We also learned that troops will be under the operational control of U.S. NORTHCOM's Joint Force Land Component Command under U.S. Army North, headquartered in San Antonio, Texas. The operational headquarters of the response force is at Fort Monroe, Virginia. The original Army Times report also stated that the use of non-lethal weapons against Americans would be a possibility, but a retraction has now been issued stating that the forces would not use non-lethal weaponry domestically. However, Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman was told by Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Jamie Goodpaster, a public affairs officer for NORTHCOM, that, quote, "military forces would have weapons on site containerized," she said, "that is, stored in containers, including both lethal and so-called non-lethal weapons. They would have mostly wheeled vehicles, but would also," she said, "have access to tanks." She said that the use of weapons would be made at a higher level, perhaps at the Secretary of Defense level. As Goodman writes in an editorial for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, with a link for you, "Talk of trouble on U.S. streets is omnipresent now with the juxtaposition of Wall Street and Main Street. The financial crisis we face remains obscure to most people. Titans of business and government officials assure us that the financial system is on the brink and that a massive bailout is necessary immediately to prevent a disaster. Conservative and progressive members of Congress, at the insistence of constituents, blocked the initial plan. If the economy does collapse, if people can't go down to the bank to withdraw their savings or get cash from an ATM, there may be serious civil unrest, and the Sea Smurfs will be called upon sooner than we imagine to assist with crowd control."
Beginning in October, the Army plans to station an active unit inside the United States for the first time to serve as an on-call federal response in times of emergency. The 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team has spent 35 of last 60 months in Iraq, but now the unit's training for domestic operations. The unit will soon be under the day-to-day control of U.S. Army North, the Army service component of Northern Command. The Army Times reports this new mission marks the first time an active unit has been given a dedicated assignment to Northern Command. The paper says the Army unit may be called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control. Soldiers are learning to use so-called non-lethal weapons designed to subdue unruly or dangerous individuals and crowds.
The use of U.S. troops in law enforcement duties is a complete violation of the Posse Comitatus Act and the Insurrection Act, which substantially limit the powers of the federal government to use the military for law enforcement unless under precise and extreme circumstances. Section 1385 of the Posse Comitatus Act states, quote, whoever, except in cases and under circumstances expressly authorized by the Constitution or Act of Congress, willfully uses any part of the Army or the Air Force as a Posse Comitatus or otherwise to execute the laws shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. Under the John Warner Defense Authorization Act signed by Bush on October 17, 2006, the law was changed to state, quote, the president may employ the armed forces to restore public order in any state of the United States the president determines hinders the execution of laws or deprives people of a right, privilege, immunity, or protection named in the Constitution and is secured by law, or opposes or obstructs the execution of the laws of the U.S. or impedes the course of justice under those laws. So it basically says the same thing, but it says Bush says, I get to say it. At which point Obama will get to say, I get to say it. Or McCain could say, I get to say it. Now, of course, it's important to note that I believe it was 50 governors signed a letter opposing at least this portion of the John Warner Defense Authorization Act, taking the power out of the hands of the state and giving it to the unitary executive. However, these changes were repealed in their entirety by H.R. 4986, National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2008, reverting back to the original state of the Insurrection Act of 1807. Despite this repeal, Bush attached a signing statement saying that he did not feel bound by the repeal. The original text of the Insurrection Act severely limits the power of the president to deploy troops within the United States. And I have that whole section posted up for you, but I'm not going to read it now. Because we got to move on, and we got to get to Chuck Norris. There's a two-part interview. He was on the Alex Jones Show just a couple days ago. But the pertinent part, of course, is when he says Ron Paul was right.
When the Republicans were in control of the Congress, in the first 6 years of Bush's, they ran us into the ground. So the Democrats said, well, we'll change everything. We'll make everything better. So now the Democrats have control of Congress, and they've run us deeper into the ground. I don't know who to trust. I don't trust any. Ron Paul's the only guy I trust. And like you heard, Alex, I said, if I had one wish, you know, if they give me one wish, I'd like to line up all the members of Congress and have Ron Paul walk with me down the line and say, okay, which one's corrupted? Which one's corrupted? And the ones he says point to is corrupted, I'm going to choke him unconscious and pile, but stick him into a pile. He's kind of an off-center joke for me.
Chuck Norris and Ron Paul choking corrupt members of Congress until they're unconscious. Oh, my good Lord. ChuckNorris.com if you want more, and all those interviews are posted up on YouTube. But speaking of the man, Ron Paul, CampaignForLiberty.com, he's all over the news lately. Of course, as I've mentioned, you know, he couldn't get arrested during the campaign, but now that he's officially out of the campaign, he's almost the sort of go-to talking head guy, because, of course, as far as the economy goes, he's been right all along and more or less predicted it all years ago. So, here he is on Bloomberg TV saying what they are doing is very seriously wrong.
Well, we're continuing our focus on the bailout bill as it moves to the House, where the jury is still out on whether it will pass or be voted down again. Joining us on the phone now from Lake Jackson, Texas, is Congressman Ron Paul, Republican representative from Texas. And Congressman Paul is a member of the Financial Services Committee and is vice chairman of its Oversight and Investigations Subcommittee. Congressman, thank you so much for being on the program. Of course, you along with millions of others have seen the market react to the House vote on Monday, but you're still saying that you are not going to be changing your no vote. Why is that?
Well, I think there have been a few improvements, like the tax cuts, you know, capital gains tax and the tax credits. If that was a single vote, I would enthusiastically support that. That doesn't cancel out all the rest, all the pork that they've added on, plus $700 billion commitment. Everything else, I think, just makes things that much worse, and I suspect that they'll finally get something passed, and my guess is that maybe the markets will like that for a little while, but quite frankly, I think our mess is so big that after this is all passed and said and done, the markets will continue to go down, and we will have our recession, and if we continue to do this kind of legislation, I think they could turn it into a depression, so I think what they're doing is very, very seriously wrong.
But Congressman, haven't your constituents been coming back to you since Monday, seeing that huge plunge in the Dow, and now urging you to actually vote for the bill because of what's going on in the markets?
No, it really hasn't changed. It still stays about 9-1. And I might get less calls than others because I think my constituents know me pretty well and they know that there's no way I'd be voting for anything like this. I mean, if it's $1 million over budget, I don't vote for it, just on principle that we're going in the wrong direction. We've been doing this for quite a few years, and we built this problem by just irresponsible spending, and so that they don't expect me to spend money like this. And
Congressman, if I can just interview, because we only have about a minute left, you know, you keep saying that we're going to be spending money like this, but, you know, some of our analysts have been pointing out $700 billion is actually just 1% of our GDP. Our debt is lower than other OECD countries. It seems like a small price to pay for salvaging our economy and our future.
Well, I don't think it will. I think it makes it worse. I think we're doing what we did in the Depression. We're trying to prop up bad debt. Housing prices should come down. We shouldn't prop them up. And if assets are illiquid, that means they're usually worthless and they need to be wiped off the books. Instead of allowing this to happen over a 3, 4, 5, 6 year period, you should do that in 6 months, and then we can go back to work again. It's sort of like propping up the stock market instead of allowing it to go down and start all over again. No, I think this is interference in the marketplace. It's the furthest thing from the free market. It's propping up bad debt with more spending, more debt, and more inflation. My big concern has been that everything we've done for 35 years,
okay. We've
papered it over with inflation. As long as you can
yep. Create
new money, you create more inflation, and that's what we're in for, the devaluation of the dollar.
Congressman, I apologize. We're coming up against our commercial break, but thank you so much. Firm in your belief there, Congressman Ron Paul.
So if we take a look over at the breaking news this morning on Friday morning, October 3rd, we see, of course, that Wells Fargo is acquiring Wachovia. But let's jump back to MediaMonarchy.com. The next posting, our political misleaders' latest bad moves. And this goes all around the board, but we're going to start in New York with 9/11. Congress ends 9/11 workers' health care bill. Thank you very much. This from New York One.
Congress has abandoned legislation to provide billions of dollars in health care for September 11th recovery workers. The program would have provided long-term care for workers who were at the World Trade Center on or shortly after September 11th. The estimated cost was at least $5 billion. Bloomberg strongly objected to a part of the bill that would have forced the city to pay for 10% of the program. He said it was an undue burden on city taxpayers. In addition, the legislation would have reopened the federal September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, adding around $6 billion to that plan. The legislation had the backing of several New York congressmen, but was overshadowed by negotiations surrounding financial bailout.
Oh, and speaking of Bloomberg, this from thinkprogress.org, as well as from the New York Times and elsewhere, Bloomberg plans to seek re-election by rewriting the term limit law. So he wants to go for a third round. So on Thursday, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg reportedly plans to announce that he will be seeking a third term, arguing that, quote, the financial crisis unfolding in New York City demands his steady hand and proven business acumen. The New York Times reports, quote, the move represents an about-face for Mr. Bloomberg, who has repeatedly said he supports term limits and once called an effort to revise the law disgusting. He will apparently try to do so through legislation in the city council rather than the ballot box. Mr. Bloomberg's gambit carries significant political risk. The city's term limit laws was passed twice by voters in 93 and 96. While they were dealing with Giuliani, probably, and several polls show widespread popular support for keeping it in place. Under the plan, Bloomberg has outlined to associates, those voters will have no say in the matter, raising the possibility of a backlash. And of course, it's important to note, speaking of Giuliani, that after 9/11, Giuliani also considered running for a third term, citing national security concerns. And that's a nice way to put it. He was basically saying, oh, since 9/11, maybe I should just stay on as a dictator, or take the crown, as my brother said last night. So, speaking of Mike Bloomberg, let's check out his Nazi friend, Arnold. Again, from thinkprogress.org, Schwarzenegger vetoes bill honoring Harvey Milk. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed a bill that would have made the birthday of gay political icon Harvey Milk a statewide day of significance. Schwarzenegger, who opposes efforts to ban same-sex marriage in the state, explained his veto by saying he believes Milk should be recognized at the local level. But the AP notes that conservative groups had lobbied the governor to oppose the measure. In his veto message issued Tuesday, the governor said that while he respected the measure's intent, he thinks milk's contributions should continue to be recognized at the local level. Conservative groups had lobbied Schwarzenegger not to sign the legislation, sponsored by Assemblyman Mark Leno of San Francisco. Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay man to hold prominent political office in America, was assassinated in 1978.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
If homosexuals are allowed their civil rights, then so would prostitutes or thieves or anyone else.
40 years old, and I haven't done a thing.
I'm not going to be forced out of San Francisco by social deviants and incorrigibles.
We need one of our own in office.
We can have a revolution here.
I don't do losing.
There she is, our new campaign manager.
You all scared of girls.
You'll be the first openly gay man elected to major office.
I think you're part of the machine now.
Society can't exist without the family.
We're not against that.
Can two men reproduce?
No, but God knows we keep trying.
These people are going to live a life of open homosexuality. They are going to be removed from their jobs.
We're going to beat this thing. We need everyone.
We lose this, we'll have anti-gay laws in all 50 states.
I know you're angry! I'm angry!
You're not like most homosexuals, I am.
Do you know a lot of homosexuals, Dan?
Harvey Milk will be stabbed and have a night of horror.
Call the police.
They probably wrote it.
You have an issue.
It's more than an issue. This is our lives we're fighting for.
You get the first go at the minute you stand at the microphone.
You don't have to go at that.
That's the trailer for Milk, coming soon from Portland, Oregon's own Gus Van Sant. And I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say that that's probably going to be a very massive film released in time for fall. It's probably going to be definitely a big Oscar winner and probably a well and good return to form for Gus Van Sant. I should also note and thank Jella Biafra years ago for turning me on to the story of Harvey Milk. So dig back, I forget which spoken word album it's on from Jella Biafra, where he talks about Harvey Milk and Dan White and the assassination, and you may know it in shorthand because the Dan White case came to be known as the Twinkie defense. So maybe you know what I'm talking about. But we're going to move on. But staying on the subject, and speaking of California corruption, Nancy Pelosi paid her husband with PAC funds. This is an exclusive from the Washington Times. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has directed nearly $100,000 from her political action committee to her husband's real estate and investment firm over the past decade, a practice of paying a spouse with political donations that she supported banning last year. Financial Leasing Services Incorporated, FLS, owned by Paul Pelosi, has received $99,000 in rent, utilities, and accounting fees from the speaker's PAC to the Future over the PAC's nine-year history. The payments have quadrupled since Mr. Pelosi took over as treasurer of his wife's committee in 2007, according to Federal Election Commission records. FLS is on track to take in $48,000 in payments this year alone, eight times as much as it received annually from 2000 to 2005 when the committee was, you know, run by somebody else. Lawmakers' frequent use of campaign donations to pay relatives emerged as an issue in the 2006 election campaigns when the Jack-off Abramoff lobbying scandal gave Democrats fodder to criticize Republicans, such as former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Texas and Representative John T. Doolittle of California for putting their wives on their campaign and PAC payrolls for fundraising work. the first of an unfortunate amount of McCain news on this week's episode of Media Monarchy, but it's always important to point out when your misleaders make references to being dictators. And of course, we know Bush has done it at least three times. If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier, just as long as I'm the dictator. But this from Paul Joseph Watson. McCain says, "I always aspire to be a dictator." So during an interview with the Des Moines Register editorial board yesterday, a couple days ago now, John McCain, presumably making an attempt at humor, said with a completely straight face that he aspired to be a dictator, while of course decrying the congressional rejection of the bailout bill.
I just want to make a comment about the obvious issue, and that is the failure of Congress to act yesterday. And you know, it's just not acceptable. We have people who are trying to buy a car that can't get a loan. We have small businesses who are dependent on a line of credit. They're seeing that cut off. I mean, this is just a not acceptable situation. I'm not saying this is the perfect answer. If I were dictator, which I always aspire to be, I would write it very different, you know, a little bit differently. I would have increased the FDIC insured deposits and done some other things, but we can't just do nothing.
I always aspire to be a dictator, says John McCain. And we'll get more into him as we go through this episode, but let's shift gears to CQ politics and a little bit of 9/11 truth news. FBI prevents agents from telling truth about 9/11 on PBS. The FBI has blocked two of its veteran counterterrorism agents from going public with accusations that the CIA deliberately withheld crucial intelligence before 9/11. FBI Special Agents Mark Rossini and Douglas Miller have asked for permission to appear in an upcoming public television documentary scheduled to air in January on pre-9/11 rivalries between the CIA, FBI, and NSA. The program is a spinoff from The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America, and that's a book from Random House by acclaimed investigative reporter James Bamford that's coming out really soon. The FBI denied Rossini and Miller permission to participate in the book or the PBS Nova documentary, which is also being written and produced by Bamford, on the grounds that the FBI doesn't want to stir up old conflicts with the CIA, according to multiple reliable sources. James Bamford, contacted by phone, said he couldn't comment because his publisher has embargoed his new book for release around October 10th. So there's the date for you. And I'm sure we'll hear more about that, and I'm sure it'll be an interesting special. James Bamford, of course, author of Pretext for War and Puzzle Palace and others, and I believe he's the one who brought us Operation Northwoods. You know, that plan they brought to Kennedy about, you know, shooting down supposed hijacked jets and trying to blame it on Cuba and provoke war. But if we return back to the Senate and back to the corrupt Congress critters and this financial terrorism that's going on right now. And it's interesting to note, take note, friends, of the semantical shift from bailout to rescue. So Frank Luntz was probably working overtime on that, coming up with the new key phrases. So bailout wasn't working, we got to step it up towards a rescue. So this from the Deutsche Press Agency, the Senate passes the bailout rescue bill, and of course, the House vote is imminent. So the Senate approved a $700 billion financial rescue package Wednesday night. The member said was essential to keep the world's largest economy from near total collapse. Senate leaders hoped the 74-25 vote would send a strong signal to the lower House of Reps, which rejected an earlier version of the bailout plan on Monday and sent U.S. stocks into a free fall. "We have sent a clear message that we will not let this economy fail for any American," said Majority Leader Harry Loser Reid, the top Democrat in the Senate. And we'll get into that a little bit more, and of course the voting down of the bailout bill, and it's important to note that Oregon Senator Ron Wyden voted no, so he was one of the 25 in the Senate. Now we have linked up, you can read all the bills, all the PDFs are linked up for you as they stand right now. Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. There's an op-ed up on thepeoplesvoice.org from Dennis Kucinich, The Bailout and What's Next. So Dennis Kucinich writes, yesterday marked a day, speaking of the bailout defeat, yesterday marked a day that will go down in history when congressional Democrats and Republicans alike took on full responsibility to protect the interests of taxpaying Americans and defeated the deceptive bailout bill, defying the dictates of the administration, the House majority leadership, the House minority leadership, and the special interests on Wall Street. Obviously, Congress must consider quickly another course. There are immediate issues which demand attention and responsible action by the Congress so that the taxpayers, their assets, and their futures are protected. So if we move to the Associated Press, House girds for second try on financial rescue. So see, the transformation is complete. It's the rescue now. House members are getting another chance to vote on a financial bailout bill, there it is, that has infuriated millions of voters after the Senate added tax cuts and other sweeteners and passed it handily. And I believe there's things like, I forget, good Lord, all the sort of bizarre pork in there, things to do with NASCAR and wooden arrows for kids' toys and all kinds of things. Senators advanced the much-criticized measure in a 74-25 vote late Wednesday, sending it, of course, to the other side of the Capitol for a showdown vote expected today, Friday, October 3rd. The move was calculated to win over enough dissenting House members to get the bill through and reverse Monday's stunning defeat in the House. Party leaders there plan to press rank-and-file members Thursday for the dozen converts they believe they need. And one more note on this, again from the Associated Press, what started as three pages, you know, the thing that basically gave Hank Paulson the financial dictatorship, and of course, Oregon Rep. DeFazio pointed that out, and all it took is three pages, and it gives it all to him. But it slowly got bigger, and now it's about the size of a novel. Two Saturdays ago, it totaled just three pages. The White House's request for a $700 billion rescue for tottering financial institutions by buying their devalued mortgage-related assets. After an intense weekend of negotiations, the draft of the bailout legislation before Congress had swelled to 42 pages. The following Friday, after almost a week of marathon talks between Paulson and key lawmakers in both parties, the working version was up to 102 pages. It went down to defeat Monday in the House, mostly at the hands of Republicans. Once the Senate was finished adding sweeteners Wednesday to entice reluctant House Republicans to change their minds and vote for the bailout, the bill heading for passage had grown to 451 pages. It was unclear whether it would expand still more as House leaders hunted for the votes needed to clear the bill. So we'll keep an eye out on Google News and see what happens. And as I glance there quickly, we note from CNN Money that jobs are the worst in 5 years. Shifting gears again, but getting back to Selection 08, and anytime there's anything Simpsons related and politics, you know I'm going to hit it. So fortunately, something has leaked out, which has to be from the upcoming Halloween episode, because you can hear the little Kang and Kodos theremin theme. But it's Homer Simpson versus electronic vote fraud.
Hello, I'd like to vote for president, governor, and anything that will take money away from our parks and library.
Use machine number 3.
Fit in the boot.
Use the double wide.
One of those electronic voting dealies.
Thank you.
I want to vote for Obama.
2 votes for McCain.
Come on, it's time for a change.
3 votes for McCain.
No, no, no.
6 votes for President McCain.
Hey, I only meant one of those votes for McCain. This machine is rigged. Must tell President McCain! Ah! This doesn't happen in America! Maybe Ohio, but not in America! Ah! Ah!
So that's Homer Simpson attempting to vote for Obama, but having electronic vote fraud and having it switched to McCain. So again, good satire, only slightly tweaked. at the point where the machine grinds him up and eats him and spits him out. So again, that's got to be from the upcoming Treehouse of Horror 19 from The Simpsons, coming soon on Fox News. Anyway, let's jump to two unrelated and unsurprising stories, pedophiles and pot. So the first from the Daily Mail out of the UK, Buckingham butler ran pedophile sex ring while working for the royal family. A former Buckingham Palace butler has been unmasked as a sexual predator who ran a pedophile ring while serving the royal family. Paul Kidd, K-I-D-D, age 55, groomed at least one of his teenage victims for sex by taking him for tea with the Queen Mother at Clarence House. To the public, he had been the most urbane gent who waited on the royals for 9 years. First the queen at the palace, and then her mother. He often publicly gushed about his blue blood employers, talking of the queen as courteous and genuinely caring. And again, more examples of elitist perversion. And so what difference is there if, you know, Buckingham butler is running a pedophile ring, or White House prostitution ensnares VPs within White House? Do you remember that Washington Times headline back in the early 90s about the kids being brought into the White House late at night? You know, Jeff Gannon and Lawrence King and Omaha and Boys Town and that whole bizarre, bizarre episode. So again, more elitist perversion, whether it's Mark Foley or Buckingham Butlers or Jeff Gannon, God knows. So, one story completely not surprising. Here's another story that isn't surprising. And again, my man, Bill Hicks. Here's a positive drug story, man. Cannabis is less harmful than drinking and smoking. Surprise! This from the AFP. Cannabis is less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, according to a report by Research Charity, which came out Thursday and called for a serious rethink of drug policy. The Beckley Foundation, which you can go to beckleyfoundation.org, a charity which numbers senior experts and other academics among its advisors, said banning cannabis has no impact on supply and turns its users into criminals. Although cannabis can have a negative impact on health, including mental health, in terms of relative harms, it is considerably less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, says the report by the foundation's Global Cannabis Commission. And so there's links there for you. I couldn't find the full report posted up yet. It might be there. I just didn't find it. But the links are there. So you can do some research, too. The government is pressing for cannabis to be reclassified in law as a Class B drug compared with its current, less serious Class C classification. So basically, the report is coming out to counter the government trying to raise the threat level, if you will, on marijuana. Now, here's a good one. Still speaking of marijuana. And I first saw the story, and it's one of those, haha, that's funny. Or, damn, that's a really good idea. Or, damn, I wish my mailman did that. What I didn't realize was that this was out of Portland. Which, of course, gives lots of people the chance to make jokes and say, haha, I bet everybody's getting it delivered to them. But anyway, Portland postman peddled pot. Mailman sentenced for dealing pot on his route. This from NBC4. A former mailman with the U.S. Postal Service will serve 18 months in prison for dealing marijuana along his mail route. Richard Berkan, B-E-R-K-A-N, 48, pleaded guilty earlier this year to distributing pot while on his mail route in the Cedar Mill area of Washington County, local station KPTV reported. As part of Berkan's sentence, almost $3,000 worth of drug proceeds will be forfeited. The investigation began in 06 when the U.S. Postal Service received a citizen complaint that a mailman was offering marijuana for sale. Investigators said they had a significant break in the case when Lake Oswego police arrested a 19-year-old who had been buying marijuana from Berkan. The teen said he had been purchasing pot from Berkan since he was back in high school. Authorities later searched Berkan's home and found 47 marijuana plants and 9 pounds of ganj. After working for the U.S. Postal Service for almost 15 years, Berkan resigned in April as part of his agreement with the prosecution. Postal carriers are trusted by the public to be honest and upstanding in carrying out their duties, said Karen Immergut, United States Attorney for the District of Oregon. In this case, not only did the defendant violate that public trust by dealing drugs on his mail route, but he also sold drugs to a person under 21 years of age. Which I don't really know what that has to do with it. But the other bit posted along with it. So we got Portland Postman peddling pot, and we've got Urbana priest selling some blow. So an Illinois campus priest accused of dealing cocaine from his rectory.
A priest arrested for allegedly selling drugs on a college campus. This is the mugshot of Father Christopher Layden. He's charged with possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver. Layden is a priest at St. John's Catholic Newman Center on the University of Illinois campus. Police say the arrest came after a two-week investigation in which authorities allegedly confiscated 3 grams of cocaine. For MSNBC.com, I'm Dara Brown.
And of course, both those stories are rife for all kinds of jokes and double entendres, but we got to move on. So let's move from my current home of Oregon to my previous home of West Virginia. A lot of stories posted up. Miners versus the NRA, DuPont appeals, eminent domain, and Santa Claus. First, from the Examiner, Miners Union slams NRA over film crew. Get this. The United Mine Workers of America is crying foul over what it says was an attempt to get miners to badmouth Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama for a camera crew. UMWA President Cecil Roberts plans to hold a news conference in Charleston at 12 p.m. Monday, which I believe he did, but I haven't found video of it. With miners from Consol Energy's Blacksville No. 2 mine in Monongahela County to criticize the National Rifle Association. Roberts says the NRA hired a film crew to get miners to criticize Obama's record on gun rights. NRA spokesman Andrew Arulamandam said Monday the crew was on the property with the mine's permission and had no troubles with the miners it interviewed. The NRA is sharply critical of Obama, calling him a, quote, lying rabble-rouser on its website, which, of course, has changed, but I got the link up to the cache of the page. So while that lasts, you can see on the NRA page, he's a lying rabble-rouser. And so it goes without saying that the UMWA has endorsed Obama. So, of course, that would be a big deal because, of course, getting more Obama bad-mouthing out of West Virginia would make great political hay. And so one of the other stories, UMW planned work stoppage over the NRA filming, but it seems like it's all going to basically subside. I don't know how far it's going to go. Again, returning to Juan McCain, despite campaign denials, McCain supports the elimination of mountaintop removal coal mining.
But I just want to get you on the record because I think you had mentioned in the past, but I'm not sure if you support the elimination of mountaintop removal mining, which has been done, I think, in West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania. That's an ecological disaster. It can be done in more environmentally friendly ways so that it will keep the economy stable in the area, but they can still have a strong economy by still extracting the coal. So do you support eliminating mountaintop removal mining and practices like that?
You know, I do, and I'm happy to tell you that I've seen a dramatic improvement in the behavior of the coal companies. They are doing a much better job. Now, it's not perfect, but it certainly is dramatically improved from what it was some years ago.
So thanks to thinkprogress.org for bringing me this story. So reading from that, when the Charleston Gazette pursued the story with the McCain campaign, they initially denied that the candidate favored an end to mountaintop removal, but backed off that when confronted with, you know, that video of him saying it. Initially, McCain spokeswoman Gail Gitcho repeatedly said the candidate did not support a ban on mountaintop removal. But when the video of his remarks in Atlanta was, or rather Orlando, was posted on YouTube, Gitcho confirmed McCain's support for ending the practice and issued a short statement. And so there's more in some links there at the Wonk Room at thinkprogress.org. More West Virginia news from the Associated Press. Residents win over power company's eminent domain threats. Allegheny Energy Incorporated, bowing to intense community opposition in southwestern Pennsylvania, has agreed to reroute a proposed multi-state high power line and move its endpoint so that only 1 mile of it passes through the state. The 500 kilovolt transmission line was to originate in Washington County, continue for 37 miles in the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania, and then cross into West Virginia on its way to Loudoun County, Virginia. The company has agreed to move the endpoint to the southern end of Greene County, Pennsylvania, about 1 mile from the West Virginia border, this said by Pam Snyder, the chairwoman for the Greene County Commissioners. In return, the county won't oppose the project. And so that's good news, because initially when I bookmarked the story, it was that people in West Virginia were going to lose their homes because of eminent domain threats. So, at least that threat seems to have subsided. But another one from the AP, West Virginia court accepts appeals in the $400 million DuPont case. West Virginia Supreme Court has agreed to a full review of appeals arising from a nearly $400 million judgment against DuPont. So they're basically trying to take down the winnings against DuPont. So I'm sure their lobbying hands are quite greasy. A Harrison County jury awarded the damages to residents last year after finding the chemical giant downplayed and lied about health threats at a former zinc smelting plant in Spelter. The High Court accepted DuPont's appeal of the verdicts and of the circuit court's judges over holding it liable for the conduct of the site's previous owner. They've been combined with an appeal from blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. I'm starting to lose the thread here, but basically, Governor Joe Manchin had urged the justices to accept the case, citing its $196 million punitive damage award. So they're trying to backpedal on punishing DuPont. That's what it breaks down to. You get it? A couple more West Virginia-related, and from the Associated Press, feds blame tank and training in fatal blast in West Virginia. Federal inspectors are blaming a fatal explosion at a West Virginia convenience store in part on a propane tank being located too close to the building. The blast in January 2007 killed 4 and injured 6. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board also found there was too little training for propane company techs and for emergency crews, and you can download the preliminary report in PDF. Finally, the funny one, which I believe I mentioned as we were looking at Google News in one of the previous episodes, West Virginia write-in candidates include Santa Claus. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, and he's running for president. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I botched the opening funny line. Yes, West Virginia. You know, the play on the Miracle on 34th Street letter in the New York Times and yada yada. Yes, for West Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, and he's running for president. This jolly old elf, though, doesn't live at the North Pole, but near Lake Tahoe, and was known as Thomas O'Connor until 2005, when his resemblance to Father Christmas helped persuade him to legally change his name. Claus is one of the 14 write-in presidential candidates registered with the West Virginia Secretary of State's office, a veritable bumper crop thanks to the state's easy registration rules. All they have to do is file a form at least 42 days before the election, said Jason Williams, manager of the Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office. Quote, Santa Claus filed his form and it was notarized, so he's registered along with everyone else. Everyone else in West Virginia includes Keith Russell David, currently an inmate at Beaumont Federal Correctional Institution in Texas, and Pennsylvania resident Ron Hobbs, whose platform includes requiring all public businesses to have restrooms. All told, there are 25 write-in candidates for statewide or congressional office in West Virginia this year. Their names won't appear on the official ballot, but votes for them will be tallied, while writing in an unregistered name will mean an uncounted vote. I don't think I've ever seen so many write-in candidates in a presidential election, said Kanawha County Circuit Court Clerk Vera McCormick, whose workers will count every write-in ballot on election night by hand. That kind of joyous plurality isn't available to voters everywhere. Most states put a number of hurdles before write-in candidates, ranging from requiring dozens of forms to identifying presidential electors for the candidate. So, wacky presidential selection 08 news out of my home state of West Virginia. But shifting back to more disturbing news from the military-industrial complex and their mass amounts of drills and armed troops in America, one of the latest is called Vibrant Response. And again, always thanks to Greg Nixon at dailydoseofterror.blogspot.com for pointing out Vibrant Response, as well as its connections and possible connections to, of course, the combat brigades and NORTHCOM. But this from the Army News Service, army.mil/news. Vibrant Response, U.S. Nuke Scenario. The exercise scenario was a sobering one, a 10-kiloton nuclear device detonating in America's heartland, quickly overwhelming civilian responders. Military leaders who recently trained for this response say they are now thinking differently about how to move equipment, extract the injured, and take care of people following this type of attack. Their insights came from Vibrant Response, a week-long command post exercise designed to train the commanders and staff of one of the nation's dedicated force for responding to, here we go again, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and high-yield explosives incidents, or Seaburn. The units completed the exercise September 18th at, there it is again, Fort Stewart in Georgia, just 2 weeks before their force, the Seaburn Consequence Management Response Force, or CCMRF, CSMRF, will be assigned to U.S. NORTHCOM to begin its mission. Assigning them will allow NORTHCOM to directly influence the operational and training focus of the forces and ensure a trained and ready response force when needed, said Colonel Lou Vogler, Chief of Future Operations at U.S. Army North. It's the first infantry brigade to be assigned to NORTHCOM for a year in order to respond quickly to the aforementioned civil support missions. So let's listen to NORTHCOM live for just a second.
Yeah, are you familiar with the plan to assign an active duty Army unit to the U.S. Northern Command for Homeland Defense? And can you comment at all about whether or not that raises questions about active duty soldiers being drawn into domestic law enforcement?
I'd have to take that, Jamie. It hadn't come across my radar, so I'm not familiar with it. I would urge you to talk to Northern Command, but if you and I want to talk further about it, I'm happy to try to look into it for you. Anything else?
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. Hopefully we'll see you next week across the way.
Oh, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm just the spokesman wearing a military outfit, but I have no idea that, of course, for the first time ever, we've assigned combat brigades to the United States. So, again, let's backtrack just a little bit and put this into perspective. They were training for a 10 kiloton nuke to go off in America's heartland. And now those guys are assigned to active duty with NORTHCOM. So again, as we've said many, many times on the show and pointed out, the drills, the military exercises in the war games, whether it's 9/11 or 7/7, or even the drills and war games that preceded the attacks in Georgia on 888. We pay attention to the drills because they just, gosh darn it, somehow have a way of going live. Maybe not immediately, but sometime right around then. I should tell you now, my friends, that we are into hour number two of episode 94 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. Coming to you October 3rd, 2008 from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 on revereradionetwork.com. And again, thanks to KBFR in Boulder and 87.9 Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta for rebroadcasting the show. And of course, MySpace, iTunes, Dig, YouTube, radioforall.net, archive.org, all those things. Make contact. Some of the latest from Collateral News, collateralnews.tv, a weekly internet news show that I really dig and try and post up all their episodes. They have two recent episodes. One of them I'm not going to play for you. It's America's Next Beauty Queen, and it's basically cutting together Sarah Palin in her bumbling interviews with Katie Couric, interspersed with the, if you recall, the, I believe, South Carolina beauty pageant girl. So, remixing the two of those and putting them together and showing you both how ridiculous they both are, because they don't sound like they know what the fuck they're talking about. But let's jump to the more important one. So, this one's called Under the Radar, and this is the first time Collateral News has done this. Three stories that have received little or no press coverage due to the current economic turmoil. So they cover three stories and invite the audience to go to collateralnews.tv and vote on which story they want to see more work on. So here's Collateral News Under the Radar number one.
Good evening. This is an extraordinary period.
There are 700 billion reasons for us to do a story on Wall Street, and we will. But this week we decided not to. Instead, we present three stories that have gotten little or no press coverage due to the current financial turmoil. Welcome to Collateral. The Defense Authorization Act of 2006 gave the President the power to deploy troops inside the U.S. Now it seems the Army is starting to prepare. According to a September 8th article in the Army Times, an infantry brigade has begun training. as an on-call federal response force for natural or man-made emergencies and disasters, including terror attacks. The 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade will be under the control of NORCOM, which was established in 2002 to control homeland defense efforts. According to the Army Times, the soldiers will help with civil unrest. They will learn how to use crowd and traffic control equipment and non-lethal weapons designed to subdue unruly or dangerous individuals without killing them. Those of you that saw the riot police in St. Paul during the Republican National Convention may wonder why we need additional forces. Apparently, our government expects growing civil unrest. Scientists fear that high quantities of the greenhouse gas methane, 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide, are being released from beneath the Arctic Sea as the water warms. So far, they have had no concrete evidence that this was happening. Now they do. As reported in the UK Independent, researchers have seen areas of sea foaming with gas bubbling up through methane chimneys rising from the sea floor. They believe that the subsea layer of permafrost, which has acted like a lid to prevent the gas from escaping, has melted away to allow methane to rise from underground deposits formed before the last ice age. However, scientists cannot yet say just how much methane is being released in this fashion into the atmosphere. 27 million men, women, and children are enslaved worldwide, more than at any time in human history, and it is not limited to the underdeveloped world. Sex slaves and bonded laborers can be found in almost all of the world's big cities. Here's an excerpt from Benjamin Skinner's article on the subject. Parents in desperate straits may sell their children, or at least be susceptible to scams that will allow the slave trader to take control over the lives of their sons and daughters. Young women in poverty-ridden communities are more likely to take risks on job offers in faraway locations. The poor are apt to accept loans that slave traders can later manipulate to steal their freedom. Thousands of traffickers lure children from impoverished rural parents with promises of scholarships, free schooling, and a better life. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, 17,500 slaves cross into the U.S. every year. That's it for now. You can go to our site and vote for the story that bugs you the most. We'll take it and make a full-length story out of it sometime in the coming weeks. See you next week.
Let's shift gears yet again to what may very well be the true passion of the New World Order elites, and that is, of course, eugenics. So a lot posted up together. Sterilization, Stope Stamps, Sanger, and more. First, again, from thinkprogress.org and a lot of other places. Let's see where some of the links from. Other Think Progress, ABC News, KSLA, NewOrleansCityBusiness.com, and more. Why is this so important? Louisiana legislator proposes paid sterilization for poor women. Louisiana State Rep. John Labruzzo, L-A-B-R-U-Z-Z-O, a Republican, recently stirred controversy by advocating a form of eugenics to decrease the number of poor. Quote, I realized that all these people were in Louisiana's care and what a massive financial responsibility that is to the state, he said. I said, I wonder if it might be a good idea to pay some of these people to get sterilized. His plan would also give tax incentives to the rich to encourage procreation. So appearing on CNN, Labruzzo defended his proposal by arguing that the taxpayers of America are kind of getting fed up with supporting welfare programs. He cited the totally reliant residents who relied on government evacuations during Hurricane Katrina. When CNN's Kira Phillips asked why he couldn't invest in education and poverty reduction programs, Labruzzo faulted the media for focusing too much on his eugenics program.
Well, in my office, of course, we're trying to deal with the problem in Louisiana in particular, but with the problem of generational welfare, where that's becoming a big problem. And you saw that in the evacuations of the storms, where these people were totally reliant on the government to handle their issues of evacuating from an imminent storm. And that's just a snapshot of what the problem is with these people being totally reliant on government to handle every issue. And with the $700 billion bailout, I think the taxpayers of America are kind of getting fed up and say, look, you know, we need people to go to work and help pull the wagon instead of generation after generation jumping into the wagon.
Well, John, instead of paying women $1,000 to tie their tubes, I mean, why not put the money or the efforts into education, into creating jobs, into maybe even if you want to go the pregnancy way, birth control and education with regard to that?
Every one of the ideas you brought up were talked about in the brainstorming session. Obviously, the media thought this was the one that they can get some ratings off of, and only talked about this this idea. We talked about getting involved in the community. How do we reach out? How do we give avenues to where these people can see other examples of you know, how to get out of poverty, how to get out of welfare? We talked about a lot of those issues. This was one that was brought up that the media grabbed hold of because it gets ratings.
You look at numbers according to the U.S. Census Bureau, and this is for 2006 to 2007. The poverty rate for families with kids was 17%, okay? However, the poverty rate for adults with no kids was even higher, 23%. So doesn't that blow your theory?
Well, I can only speak to Louisiana, and I'm a representative of Louisiana.
That is Louisiana. That is the state of Louisiana.
In Louisiana, the problem of generational welfare is a big problem, and we need to deal with it. And that's what we were brainstorming about. I don't think this would have ever made it to drafting and legislation. But, of course, you know, the media wants to have ratings, and this is what they want to talk about. Instead of talking about the issue, which is how do we get fewer people...
But we are talking about the issue.
Into paying taxes and being productive members of society, and it's better for them, it's better for everybody involved.
So
that's the point.
But
that's
isn't that education, isn't that creating jobs, isn't that really getting into your community and trying to help the people versus saying, tie your tubes, we'll pay you $1,000.
Well,
why not take these people and say, hey, we got jobs here, we got better education here, let's put money in. Hey, I lived in New Orleans and worked in New Orleans, and it is a shame the condition that so many of these schools are in. And how much money is divided in this city. And you have the power to really make change there. Instead of paying people to tie their tubes, you could put that money into incredible educational opportunities.
All those things are on the table, and we're talking about all these opportunities. And once again, in Louisiana, we had a tremendous influx of illegal aliens, so that's you know, bringing down the economy even more. That's another issue that some of my opponents on the other side of the aisle don't want to bring up, and they don't want to talk about.
Well,
so it's a big problem, and it needs to be addressed. And if all else, we at least brought up the issue of generational welfare is a problem, and I hope we can address and come to some solution that works. Obviously, this one's probably not it, but let's talk about it.
Yeah, let's talk about it. But let's move on and jump to scienceblogs.com. There's an article called None Dare Call It Eugenics. But if we move to another one from Paul Joseph Watson, magazine promotes sterilization for women in their 20s. A popular women's magazine in the UK recently featured an article entitled Young, Single, and Sterilized, with a scan for you, in which women in their 20s discussed why they had undergone an operation to prevent them from ever having children. The article is little more than PR for a woman's charity called Marie Stopes International, STOPES, an organization that carries out abortions and sterilizations and was founded by a Nazi eugenicist who advocated compulsory sterilization of non-whites and, quote, those of bad character. The story appears in a weekly magazine called Love It. One of the women featured in the article, Chloe, explains why she decided to have herself sterilized at the age of 20. And that article goes on, and there's another one from max-bro.net, 33 disturbing but true facts about eugenics. But if we jump to memphisrap.com, Planned Parenthood accused of genocide on blacks since 1921. A genocide on the black community is what a group of African-American pastors is saying about the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. According to the pastors and other activists, the birth control center and abortion provider has had a racist agenda since its beginnings in 1921. Every day, over 1,500 black babies are murdered inside the black woman's womb, said Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson of Brotherhood Organization of a New Destiny, Bond. And that's at bondinfo.org. And according to Peterson, there is a race issue. The group held a press conference in front of a Planned Parenthood clinic in D.C. and stated that they're angry at results of a recent undercover inquiry into several Planned Parenthood clinics across the country. And again, all these links are in there. And so we mentioned Marie Stopes. So this from LifeSiteNews.com. British government chooses Hitler-loving abortion movement pioneer for stamps. Marie Stopes, the notorious early 20th century contraception campaigner, eugenicist, and anti-Semite, did for Britain what Margaret Sanger did for the U.S., preached the doctrines of eugenics and promoted contraception and sterilization to achieve, quote, racial hygiene. So successful was she at altering British society in favor of her eugenics doctrines, the British government has chosen her to be included in a Women of Distinction line of stamps. The Royal Mail announced this weekend that the face of Marie Stopes, who advocated the sterilization of poor women to promote the welfare of the race, will be featured on a 50p stamp. The stamps will be available beginning October 14th. So columnist Gerald Warner wrote on his weblog at the Daily Telegraph, quote, "Considering the hysteria nowadays attaching to the issues of race, at first it seems extraordinary that Stopes should have ever earned commemoration on a stamp. To the politically correct establishment, however, even racist peccadillos can be ignored to honor a pioneer who helped promote the anti-life culture and relieve women of the intolerable trauma of giving birth to a child with a cleft palate." There's another one from RedOrbit.com. "Informed consent or institutionalized eugenics, how the medical profession encourages abortion of fetuses with Down syndrome." Another one, "YouTube blocks videos exposing Planned Parenthood's support of race-selective abortion." A YouTube video that revealed Planned Parenthood's support for race-selective abortion was first audio-censored and has just recently been removed completely from YouTube for a supposed terms of use violation. Lila Rose, president of Live Action, or Live Action, UCLA's campus pro-life group and editor of The Advocate, but not that The Advocate, a pro-life student magazine at UCLA. There's another one from alternate.org. "Major anti-immigration figure can't pretend he's not a racist anymore." Another one on Planned Parenthood and their dirty little secrets from dailycampus.com. "Planned Parenthood, an organization that claims to promote women's health and well-being, has a deeply stained history of racism, hatred, and lies. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, summed up the purpose of her organization with this statement, quote, more children from the fit, less from the unfit. It sounds like something out of Nazi Germany, like eugenics or creating a master race." Which, of course, there's the great connection between Sanger and Hitler. He praised her. We didn't get it from him. He got it from us. So there's another one, "Election 2008 and the Eugenics Issue." That's from pewsitter.com. One from yoursock.com, E-U-R-S-O-C, you know, like Ingsoc, Your Sock. "Logan's Run Revisited, A Duty to Die." Remember the old sci-fi movie Logan's Run, which of course they're remaking because now the eugenics agenda is back in the front burner. "A few centuries from now, population growth puts so much pressure on the world's resources, it's decided that the young should lead sybaritic lifestyles while the old, that is, anyone over 30, are killed off to prevent them from taking up space. It could well be a parable for our times. It takes 2 centuries plus countless catastrophes for the Logan's Run dystopia to be created, but the idea that those who are a drain on resources should be eliminated would have to gain respectable currency somewhere along the way. Who better to speak the unspeakable than 84-year-old Baroness Warnock, who has argued that euthanasia should not only be legal, but that the elderly and infirm should be pressed towards death. Baroness Warnock speaks as one of Britain's most respected and best-connected authorities on health and ethics. She's described by the Daily Telegraph as Britain's leading moral philosopher, and in the 1980s, she sat on a committee which advised on embryo research. So finally, there's one from the Wall Street Journal. "Judge says, don't get pregnant. A lapsed law sees a new life." And so that's all on the eugenics tip with paid sterilization, Stopes stamps, and Sanger. Now, again, I'm not weighing into any sort of right or wrong at all. However, what I am pointing out is the roots of the things we defend. And fortunately, those pastors totally have it right. And of course, they don't get front page action because they're not Sharpton or Jackson. But they're right. Sanger called black people weeds. And she started your much-beloved Planned Parenthood. But I digress, and we got to move on. At the top of the show, I played a new cut, and it's the first track from the brand-new record from Washington, D.C.'s Thievery Corporation. And that one was called Sound the Alarm. So, the record just came out. And as everything was going crazy with the October 1st combat brigades and too much news overload, I stepped outside, smoked a cigarette, and click through the latest Thievery Corporation. And so what I realized is that I guess there's no escaping the new awakening. So the first track, which we heard, Sound the Alarm, It's Martial Law, grabbed my attention, of course. And then, halfway through the record, there's a song called 33 Degree, with lyrics about the shadow government and the Federal Reserve. So let's listen to 33 Degree from the new record from Thievery Corporation, Radio Retaliation. Music from Thievery Corporation, 33 Degree from the new record Radio Retaliation. And in a Billboard article I have linked up and a couple other things, Rob and Eric from the group basically say it's about people finding out that the official story on most things is a complete fraud. So it sounds to me like Thievery Corporation have made a truther record. And it's on their own label, ESL Records, 18th Street Lounge. Dig it. Getting back into the economy for just a second, we've of course touched on the fact that the big financial bailout deal failed last Monday, 228 to 205. And of course, all the good, important people voted no, like Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich and Blumenauer and DeFazio and others. But this from, again, thinkprogress.org. The Congress voted down the proposed bipartisan bailout package. The vote failed in part because the GOP leadership failed to deliver the 70 to 100 votes needed from the conservative side. Before the vote, House Majority Leader John Boehner, or Bonner, implored his GOP colleagues to vote in favor of the blah-bitty-blah. So basically, when asked what happened might or what might happen if the $700 billion rescue plan failed to pass, billionaire investor Warren Buffett said, "Heaven help us." The Dow Jones then dropped more than 700 points as the no votes mounted. So it was 777. But let's get back into Selection 08. Now it's Obama and a foundation-funded color revolution. So you should Google that. Webster Tarpley talks about it a lot, and we're going to get to him here in just a minute. But it's basically the big funding from folks like Buffett and Soros and others that promote these sort of color revolutions in European countries, and it kind of looks like fascism. So the governor of Missouri, this isn't a small politician, the governor of Missouri condemns Obama's police state tactics. So this from governor.mo.gov. Governor Matt Blunt issued the following statement on news reports that have exposed plans by U.S. Senator Barack Obama to use Missouri law enforcement to threaten and intimidate his critics. And they're calling them Obama Truth Squads. I wonder where they got that name from.
Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign is asking Missouri law enforcement to target anyone who lies or runs a misleading television ad during the presidential campaign. This first, John Mills has lied to the county election board in Maplewood. He's been learning more about which members of law enforcement are getting involved in this. John, tell us more about this.
Russell, good evening. Prosecutors and sheriffs from across Missouri are joining something called the Barack Obama Truth Squad. Two high-profile prosecutors are part of the team. We met them this afternoon in the Central West End. They are Jennifer Joyce from the city, Bob McCullough, the St. Louis County prosecuting attorney. They will be reminding voters that Barack Obama is a Christian who wants to cut taxes for anyone making less than $250,000 a year. They also say they plan to respond immediately to any ads and statements that might violate Missouri ethics laws.
We want to keep this campaign focused on issues. We don't want people to get distracted, and Missourians don't want to be distracted by these divisive character attacks. So we're here to respond to any character attacks, to set the record straight.
Whether it is directly attributable to the campaign or to one of the soft money operations, if they're not going to tell the truth, then somebody's going to step up and say, wait a minute, that's not true, this is the truth.
Now, the Obama campaign tells News 4 that others, prosecutors and sheriffs, are also part of the team, including some from the Kansas City area and from rural parts of Missouri. We're also told the Truth Squad is expected to include Jefferson County Sheriff Glenn Boyd. Live in Maplewood, John Mills.
So if you criticize Barack Obama in Missouri, you're going to go to jail. So some nice quotes from the governor of Missouri, Matt Blunt. Barack Obama needs to grow up. Enlisting Missouri law enforcement to intimidate people and kill free debate is reminiscent of the Sedition Act and is not a free society. So again, Obama's black shirts, the fascista. So that segues into our next one from CBS 13 in Sacramento by way of Raw Replay. Obama signs vandalized in California neighborhood. As well, if we jump to WHEC-TV, thieves target Obama yard signs in New York. And so my only interesting speculation out loud is, I wonder if that could be a false flag attack.
Authorities in Carmichael are investigating a vandalism attack after someone ripped down Obama signs and left anti-democratic statements behind. Residents are now concerned the suspects could take it up a notch.
Stuck up like this, as I recall, and then it was just thrown over like that.
Gerard Morin can't believe someone would use the cloak of darkness to rip down Obama signs, then leave one-page anti-democratic statements behind.
In addition to the placards being defaced and torn up, there was an ideological rant that was stapled onto every placard that I noticed in the neighborhood.
Morin found the signs while going for a jog this morning on Stanley Avenue in Carmichael. Neighbors aren't sure where the suspect suspect or suspects came from, but they do have their suspicions.
Could be a neighbor, could be somebody here, is actually what I was thinking. And I hate to say that.
With just weeks away from electing a new president, neighbors are concerned this could play out not only on Stanley, but other streets across the country.
I think that people are heated up about it, and so I hope that people will allow others to be able to say what they want to and to put up a sign or speak out about who they want and be respectful.
Well, police are still looking into the vandalism. One resident says they don't believe their neighbors will put those signs back up because they don't want the suspects to return.
A theft ring in some parts of Monroe County with the thieves not trying to break into your home, just your front yard. Dozens of Barack Obama lawn signs have been stolen in Brighton and Rondequoit. Others have been vandalized. Brooke Green tracked down some of the political victims. He is live near Mercy High School in Brighton. Berkeley.
Jen, it's calm and quiet here tonight. There's an Obama sign at a house a couple of doors down, and there's two signs on this property, just kitty corner. Now, this is the house of Jane Bleague, a big Obama supporter, and this is the house that the Obama burglars have targeted the most.
Jane Bleague stands at a living room window, dying to catch the person who keeps stealing her Obama signs.
If someone would lend me a video that's motion sensitive, I would set it up to try and nail whoever it is.
Bleague says her lawn signs started disappearing early this year. It was happening every few months. Now, it's every few days.
I bought 10 of them.
So she's just ordered a new batch for herself and her neighbors.
We're keeping our fingers crossed, but I bought 10 signs so that if these go, they're going to get replaced immediately. I've been keeping some of our neighbors supplied.
Her Obama signs have been stolen off her front yard for the last 4 months, and recently it's happening every 4 days. But this Joe Robot sign across the street has never been touched.
Bleague finally went to police and filed a larceny report for theft of the Obama campaign signs, and she's not the only one. Brighton police say they've had dozens of calls about the thefts. And so is a Rondequoit. But the crime here can be different. It's vandalism. Ken Preston heads the local Obama campaign.
You know, this is America, and everybody has a right to express who they support for office. And this is not the way to do it, by stealing property.
We're going to cut it there. But we're going to jump to WorldNet Daily. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac execs now offering advice to Obama. Campaign contributions from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac made to Barack Obama may backfire if the Democratic presidential hopeful wages an aggressive campaign to cast blame on McCain and the Republicans in Congress for the mortgage-related losses that forced the U.S. Treasury to take over the quasi-governmental mortgage giants. A review of FEC records back to 1989 reveals Obama, in his 3 complete years in the Senate, is the second largest recipient of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae campaign contributions, behind only Senator Dodd, the powerful chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. Dodd was first elected in 1980. But according to OpenSecrets.com, from 89 to 2008, Dodd received $165,000 from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, while Obama, with second place, $126,000+ in such contributions, being elected to the Senate in 2004. So almost as much in a far shorter time. And again, it's all Goldman Sachs and Brzezinski and... yeah, you know. So, from Progressive Press and Webster Tarpley, he's also now has the unauthorized biography of Barack H. Obama, in addition to Obama, the Postmodern Coup. A massive, devastating expose. Obama, a classic existentialist anti-hero, is utterly without principles, perfect for a career in the most corrupt turf in the USA, the Chicago political machine. Fraud and graft reach dizzying heights. His close cronies, the felons Al Samari, Ouchie, and Rezko, have stolen hundreds of millions. And Obama and his controllers, Big New Brzezinski, will take us to the cleaners like we've never been before. Who is Brzezinski, you might ask? Well, of course, he was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, and he is one of Obama's chief foreign policy advisors. He writes books with names like The Grand Chessboard, and tells us we need to stop fucking around in the Middle East and we need to get it on with Russia. So, Brian Kinney from We Are Change confronted Zbigniew Brzezinski for the third time, this time on the radio, on the Brian Lehrer radio show. This was back on September 26th. So here's Zbig.
Mr. Brzezinski, thanks for coming back on WNYC. Good morning.
Nice to be with you again. Good morning.
Here is a related question, I think, from a caller, Brian in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Zbigniew Brzezinski. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Brian. Two-part question from Mr. Brzezinski. A, does he think there was any blowback from our funding the Mujahideen in the 70s against the Russians? And B, what was he doing at the Bilderberg Group, and why is there no press allowed inside?
Well, on the second question, I'm not a member of the Bilderberg Group, so you better go to someone that is. I'm not a member of the Bilderberg Group, so you better go to someone that is. On the first question, the fact is that our help to the Afghans in resisting the Soviets made it possible for us to overthrow the Taliban in Afghanistan with only 300 U.S. military personnel. We didn't have to have more because the Afghans were on our side. They were grateful for what we did in helping them against the Soviets. The problem has developed, however, over the last 7 years, namely that we're staying, we're increasing our military presence, we're militarizing our efforts in Afghanistan, we're now spreading these efforts into Pakistan, and this is what I'm warning against.
Brzezinski, the funder of the Mujahideen, which turned into Al-Qaeda, or Al-Qaeda, pulling the strings. You better look into Brzezinski. And if we have time, we're going to get more into Brzezinski and, of course, his sons and daughters, who were involved in both campaigns for the supposed enemies in WWF. As always, it's good to get a little distance from things. In an appeal to working-class voters, Barack Obama claimed his economic plan would save millions of back-breaking, mind-numbing, shitty jobs.
Obama launched a tour of six heartland states today, focusing on the economy. Jane Carmichael in the War for the White House election analysis bunker has more. Jane?
Thanks, Andrea. Obama will be meeting with blue-collar workers from Indiana to Ohio this week to impart the message that, if elected, he would stop Americans' shitty jobs from going overseas. A statement from the Obama campaign today said the tour's purpose is to, quote, send the message that we must stop the outsourcing of our most tedious and dangerous jobs to other countries. That shit work can and should be done by Americans. The message resonated with auto factory worker Lou Warren, who recently lost his shitty job screwing seats onto riding lawnmowers when his factory relocated to Ecuador.
My grandfather had a shitty job, my father had a shitty job, and I would like to see a president who could guarantee that my son will have a shitty job.
The Obama campaign is using the tour as a way to call attention to their Keep Shit Work in America plan, which entails creating tax credits for American companies that keep awful, low-paying jobs at home, and creating tariffs to protect American goods from nations with even shittier wages.
We're not asking for much, just a chance to work our fingers down to the bone for very little money. And I believe that Barack Obama can get back on our feet 12 to 14 hours a day.
The plan wouldn't just promote shitty job creation, but would also increase funding for on-the-shit job training to give every worker the opportunity to advance from the shitty job they are in to a slightly better paying shitty job. To coincide with the tour, this week Obama released a new TV ad stating his commitment to protect America's drained and beat down workers.
Yes, we can. Get Americans dangling over a vat of molten lead in a steel factory. Yes, we can. Get you molding noxious plastic into beach chairs. Yes, we can. Get your entire extended family sitting on stools, inserting voice boxes into a never-ending stream of SpongeBob toys.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Thank you, Jane. In response, the McCain campaign released this statement today, quote, America needs to focus on the shitty jobs of the future, like telemarketing, customer service, and mind-numbingly boring office jobs.
Oh, Onion, thank you. But if we jump, of course, thanks to Fox News for bringing this to my attention, Obama's My Muslim Faith gaffe fuels new round of rumor busting. Thank you again, Fox News. Barack Obama's campaign brushed off suggestions Monday that a verbal gaffe the Democratic candidate made during a weekend television interview is anything more than just that.
You mentioned Christian faith. Yesterday you took off after the Republicans for suggesting you have Muslim connections. Just a few minutes ago, Rick Davis, John McCain's campaign manager, said they've never done that. This is a false and cynical attempt to play victim.
You know what? I mean, these guys love to throw a rock and hide their hand. The
McCain campaign has never suggested you have a Muslim connection.
No. But I don't think that when you look at what is being promulgated on Fox News, let's say, and Republican commentators who are closely aligned to these folks.
John McCain said that's wrong.
No, well, look, the listen, you and I both know that the minute that Governor Palin was forced to talk about her daughter, I immediately said, that's off limits.
And John McCain said the same thing about crushing your faith.
And what was the first thing the McCain campaign went out and did? They said, these liberal blogs that support Obama are out there attacking Governor Palin. Let's not play games. What I was suggesting, you are absolutely right that John McCain has not talked about my Muslim faith, and you're absolutely right that that has not
Christian
come
faith.
That my Christian faith. And, well, what I'm saying is he has suggested that I'm a Muslim, and I think that his campaign upper echelons have not either. What I think is fair to say is that coming out of the Republican camp, there have been efforts to suggest that perhaps I'm not who I say I am when it comes to my faith, something which I find deeply offensive.
So from that bizarre note, let's get into something a little more salient. Brzezinski and all his familial connections to both campaigns. So this from Raw Replay. McCain attacks Mika Brzezinski as an Obama supporter. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski talked with John McCain about the accuracy of his campaign advertisements. McCain replied, "I know you're a supporter of Senator Obama." ... Mika took exception to being labeled as an Obama supporter and reminded McCain that her brother works for his campaign.
Senator, I want to ask you about campaign ads. Do you think the Obama campaign ad, using your words about the fundamentals of the economy, do you think that ad was fair?
It's not up to me, Mika, to make those kinds of judgments. I'll leave it up to the American people. I still say to you, and I know you're a supporter of Senator Obama, if you would urge him to come and do town hall meetings with me, as I've asked him to do time after time, the whole tenor of the campaign would change. Joe will tell you that when you stand on the stage with your opponent and listen to the American people and respond to them, that changes the whole campaign. Initially, he said anytime, any place. Now he refuses to do so. I don't think that's helpful to the American people or to the tenor of the campaign.
Supporter of Senator Obama.
He's been listening to me too much.
Sure.
I got to stop poking at you on that one.
I characterize myself as that, no. But that's okay.
Mr. Scarborough.
Yeah.
Matthew LePapik, I just want to say hello.
Oh,
great,
hey.
Wonderful to meet you.
Great to meet you.
But I got a question for you.
Okay.
Well, you're acquainting 9/11 truthers with terrorists
okay.
on television.
All right. Have a good night.
Come on, really, really seriously? John, over here.
Why don't you pick up another hobby?
John, over here on this side.
No, I'm getting these people.
Who Brzezinski is? You know what this man is, what he stands for?
Hey,
Mika, up here. Come on, Mr. Scarborough. Why don't you answer the questions about 9/11 truth instead of making up answers and propaganda? Come on, Mika.
Oh, cool.
Excuse me, Mr. Scarborough? Mika, any reason why you're trying to destroy this country?
Okay, so that second part was a little We Are Change camera-breaking confrontation with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. I tagged that on and that video is up there. Okay, but the important thing to get back to is Zbigniew Brzezinski and his sons and daughters and their connections to both campaigns. So, a comment made is that McCain may have a point here, calling Mika Brzezinski an Obama supporter. Since Mika's father, Zbigniew Brzezinski, former national security advisor to Carter, is a top policy advisor for Barack Obama's campaign. Though, for all I know, she supported some of her other, some other globalist puppet. But it just goes to show you how closely related the tightly controlled propaganda news wing is to the tightly controlled two-party dictatorship. And I forget, it's Mark Brzezinski, I believe, that works with McCain. And Mika is on television. And again, Zbigniew Brzezinski funded the Mujahideen, which turned into Al-Qaeda. Writes books called The Grand Chessboard and how we need to assert Western hegemony and to stop fucking around in the Middle East, and let's get it on with Russia and China. And that's the kind of guy that's pulling strings right now. But if we get into a little bit more of the new financial world order, this from the UN News, so they would know. Gordon Brown calls for a new global financial order. Of course, Gordon Brown many times has called for a new world order, of course, as the Bushes and Clintons and all the others have called for. The Prime Minister of the UK called for a new global financial system to bring an end to the current economic turmoil, laying out five principles on which the order should be based as he addressed the General Assembly annual high-level debate. Quote, "This has been an era of global prosperity. It's been an era also of global turbulence," Gordon Brown said at the United Nations headquarters in New York on bloody Rockefeller land. "To bring an end to the culture of irresponsibility, we must now build a new global financial order founded on transparency, not opacity, rewarding success, not excess, responsibility, not impunity, and which is global, not national." So again, we need a global financial body. Or hell, maybe we just need a new currency here in America since we've let the dollar fall apart. Perhaps we need a North American currency. But we mentioned him before and he said, heaven help us. But of course, anytime someone like William Buffett opens his mouth, I guess like E.F. Hutton, when he talks, people listen. So here's a reference to Buffett, who of course you remember on the morning of 9/11 meeting with Ann Tatlock, who was supposed to be in the World Trade Center, and Bush landed at Offutt Air Force Base and all that stuff. But anyway.
Well, let's head to the White House now. Ed Henry there. This plan, does the White House like it? And also, how involved is the president here? Does he have much, muscle he can actually push around these guys, some of his Republicans there, to get them on board with this plan?
That's a big question moving forward, TJ, whether or not the president really has the juice, the clout to bring this to conclusion. He's at least gotten through, it looks like, the first major stage here. And I can tell you White House officials are saying they're cautiously optimistic about this first step that Kate's been reporting on, this sort of framework for an agreement on Capitol Hill. And they're cautiously optimistic that it can eventually become law. But there are several hurdles that have to be cleared. I can tell you from here, officials are saying that the stakes could not be any higher for the U.S. economy. In fact, one of the experts that lawmakers were consulting with in the wee hours last night about what these various provisions would do to the U.S. economy was a legendary investor, Warren Buffett. And I spoke to some people who were in contact with him last night who were saying that Buffett was saying in very stark terms that if Congress did not act quickly, that the U.S. could face the biggest financial meltdown in its history. It gives you an idea of the kind of advice and counsel Congress was getting in the wee hours. And when they emerged from those late night talks, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who has been the president's point man, suggested they're on board.
So it's Warren Buffett. I knew I had it wrong. If we jump to winterpatriot.blogspot.com, is our financial crisis a new 9/11? Yeah, chumps think so, and so do I. I've seen a remarkable number of mentions of 9/11 in connection with the current so-called financial crisis. Most of them have come from people who have seemed to have no knowledge or interest of what actually happened on 9/11, and yet all they seem to get, the parallel. How odd. Or perhaps maybe not. The most prominent common features, in my view, between the so-called terrorist attacks of 2001 and the so-called financial crisis of 2008 are, it's an inside job. A terrorist attack of unprecedented scope and scale enabled by statements from politicians in the media which are chock full of lies and spin. There was nothing sudden about it. It was foreseen by many and it could have been prevented if the government had wanted to prevent it. Instead, it has been encouraged and facilitated by the very people who claim to be keeping you safe. But you can't see that they don't want you to feel safe. They want you to be afraid. Be very afraid. So again, another visit from the go-to political guy, it seems, because he seems to be the only guy who makes sense. And of course, Chuck Norris says he's the only guy he trusts. But of course, Ron Paul was right. And he's also right when he says that Greenspan and Bernanke should be criminally charged.
Obviously, it is very, very serious, and we've been warning about it, as you have on your radio program, and it's here. But when they say that if we don't do exactly as they say and turn over more of our money and more of our liberties and exempt themselves from any court in the whole nation, they're trying to intimidate us and stampede us into doing the wrong thing. But they're also right when they say that if they don't do that, we're going to have serious problems. Yes, we are. That's what they want, and they don't want any review of any court. So they want dictatorship. They want to pass all the penalty and suffering on the average person on Main Street. They talk about illiquid assets, but what they should say is assets that have no value, that everybody would know what they're talking about. And they just want to dump the real assets on us, and the bankers and others who are in special locations will pick up the pieces of the good assets that were left over. And we will have a depression or a recession. It's locked in place due to the previous Federal Reserve action. The only question is whether this will last 1 year or 10 years and a full decade, and we lose a lot of liberties in the meantime. And I was saying earlier that it looks like, from what I sense in this Congress, that they're opting out for a decade plus of depression rather than saying, well, let's correct our ways, let's balance the budget, let's cut taxes, let's bring our troops home, do the sensible things. And what they're going to do is more the same of printing money and spending, so that will prolong the agony and prevent the corruption that is mandatory.
Asked if civil unrest was a possibility in the midst of an economic depression, referencing, of course, the Army Times report that armed combat brigades are available starting 2 days ago on October 1st, fresh from Iraq, here for Homeland Patrols and crowd control, Paul said, quote, "Are we going to have martial law, or are we going to have more freedom? The more problems we have, the more likely it is that we're going to have martial law, so I do think they anticipate and they plan for these things." If we jump now to op-ed news quickly, U.S. banking collapse, a controlled demolition. What does the rest of the world know that we don't? That the United States dollar is dead. So while we're being jerked around by the MSM here at home, the rest of the world's already drawn the final conclusion for us, and what they're saying about us isn't pretty. We're in the middle of a crisis much larger than most Americans could imagine. A portion of America can't even handle it, for that matter. The bailout or rescue is an awful idea, and the majority of Americans realize that. And, of course, the provisions giving Paulson dictatorial powers. The important part here, and this is quite interesting. Journalist and expert economist Max Kaiser on television recently compared Paulson to the 9/11 hijackers, calling him a financial terrorist. And then he goes to work in some 9/11 truth. Kaiser has been making his rounds on international broadcasts, including France 24 and Press TV, where he compares the collapse of the U.S. banking system to World Trade 7, a controlled demolition.
Well, joining me now on the phone is Max Kaiser, the journalist and broadcaster, live from Paris in France. Max, Goldman and Morgan now subject to regulation. Isn't this what critics of their highly geared dealing have been demanding for years?
I'm not so sure, Ashton. I think this is a great way for them now to hide any close examination of their books. I think this is actually in the cards from the beginning, because, as you know, Morgan and J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs have been involved in a tremendous amount of, let's call it euphemistically, money laundering over the years. And now, by becoming a commercial bank, I believe that this is going to insulate themselves from any real close examination, because they're going to be behind the firewall, behind Hank Paulson's firewall. You know, Hank Paulson has effectively hijacked the U.S. financial system. He's no different than the 9/11 hijackers, as far as I'm concerned. He's a financial terrorist, and he's taken the U.S. banking system to the edge of the abyss, all for the benefit of the shareholders and his cronies at Goldman and J.P. Morgan. The U.S. taxpayer, the U.S. citizen, unfortunately, is going to get the short end of the stick.
But doesn't the new regulatory provision, because they will now be holding companies, mean that we can expect loads of SEC, U.S. Treasury officials all flying around the world to Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs' offices, checking all the records, interviewing the staff, checking on probity?
Yes, but at the same time, as the coup d'etat has taken place and given Hank Paulson dictatorial power to determine what is fact, the information that should be disclosed or not disclosed, combine that with Bush's dictatorial powers to declare a state of emergency at the drop of a hat, I don't think we're going to see any of this information is going to see the light of light of day. It's just like, you remember Building 7 on 9/11 is where they had all those Enron records, and those Twin Towers collapsing was kind of a cover to keep those records from being examined. You know, these guys will stop at nothing to keep their dirty laundry a secret.
Even all the auditing companies that now these banks will be Have to be scrutinized by under federal law.
What auditing companies? The ones that have been discredited for the last 10 years and going out of business, like Arthur Anderson, who is auditing Enron, for example. The auditing companies, the rating agencies, the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve Bank, this is a criminal syndicate. This should be investigated under RICO. These guys are wholesale thieving of trillions of dollars. The rest of the world, unfortunately or fortunately, will wake up to the fact that they should probably get out of the U.S. dollar, because that's the only tether between the rest of the world and this criminal syndicate on Wall Street headed up by Hank Paulson. So once they figure that out, the dollar goes into permanent decline, and the rest of the world will escape this nightmare of U.S. banking. Hank Paulson has become kind of like a Colonel Kurtz character. He's gone insane. Nobody can stop him. They need to send like a Martin Sheen guy up the river to find him and take him out, because he's taking the entire U.S. economy into oblivion.
Max Keiser working in 9/11 Truth in his allegories with the current financial new world order. And as we glance over to Google News, we see that the House vote begins on the quote-unquote bailout. Oh, wait, that's right. It's a rescue now. We've had the semantical shift to the rescue. But quickly, last couple things from existentialistcowboy.blogspot.com. Evidence that Bush will exploit crisis to declare martial law, again noting the combat troops available October 1st for crowd control and insurrection, and of course noting that Bush is a guy who thinks the Constitution is a, quote, goddamn piece of paper. So lastly, and I don't know if I can fully get into all this, and this is what happens, they're masters of misdirection. With all eyes on the bailout, the House passed a $1 trillion defense bill. So on Wednesday, the House passed a mammoth defense bill by a 392-39 vote. It's part of a $1 trillion stopgap measure to keep programs running through next March. And so, again, the PDFs are there, and there's some videos and things. I don't have time to fully get into it, but yes, a $1 trillion defense deal. So while we're talking about some supposed $700 billion, they quietly pass a $1 trillion. Sweetheart deal for the private military industrial complex. So we're going to have to get the rest of the news on the B-side next week on MediaMonarchy.com. So lastly, let's hit some of the creepy customers visiting MediaMonarchy.com. We had Columbia Power and Water Systems out of New York City. Virginia Tech, reading about the Department of Justice stalling the anthrax investigation. Liberty University, that was Falwell's University, out of Lynchburg. They Googled 9/11 market crash. DreamWorks out of San Francisco Googled money as debt. Indiana Historical Society Googled eugenics Arkansas book. The Georgia Institute of Technology out of Atlanta Googled CIA recruitment ad children. The Susan Davis International Group out of Washington, D.C. were reading about the 9/11 anniversary memorial hole posting on Media Monarchy. Federal Express out of Memphis Googled Joannita's Griggs Foundation. And of course, Joannita's, George Joannita's, ties in with the RFK case. CUNY out of Brooklyn Googled Ewan Cameron. Of course, CIA's MK Ultra mad scientist of mind control. Florida Department of Management Services Googled Alamo plus cult, and we didn't have time to get to that. Tony Alamo, cult leader arrested for kid sex. We'll have to hit that on the B-side. The Drug Enforcement Administration returning after an absence to MediaMonarchy.com. Syntec Group out of Arlington, Virginia, reading about officers being blamed for the Pat Tillman case errors. Northern Ireland Civil Service Googled military doomsday plane. The Central Intelligence Agency from Fairfax, Virginia, was visiting MediaMonarchy.com on the posting about the horrifying CIA recruitment ads, which we covered last week. Evergreen Medical Group out of Linwood, Washington. We had OSHA out of Suitland, Maryland, Googling top off five. Prudential Securities out of Irvington. They're reading about the foreclosure sign on the U.S. flag near the Bronze Bowl on Wall Street. CBS out of New York. The Oregon Health and Science University right here in Portland, OHSU. Halliburton out of Texas Googled Portland and black helicopters. The Department of Veteran Affairs in Washington, D.C. visited, as well as the Navy Network Information Center. The City of New York reading about, of course, the death of Barry Jennings. We had North Dakota State University and the Lexington Fayette Urban County Government out of Lexington, Kentucky, Googling contents of Oswald's wallet, which, of course, we covered several weeks ago. And you have to ask the question, which wallet? Oh, that's right. They found two Oswald wallets. But we're going to have to leave it there, my friends. This has been episode 94 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 3rd, 2008. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster, and I love doing it for you. So get in touch with me through IM or Skype or Yahoo, Media Monarchy, and we'll keep doing it, and we'll keep getting through it. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.